Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're going to extend Audio Open Lines for a few minutes here because one other thing we want to stick in, and that is an update on this Episcopal church out in California that found itself on the wrong side of the tax code because of a sermon that was preached by its retired pastor several years ago during the last presidential cycle. And they were threatened with the loss of their tax-exempt status, and they've decided they're going to fight the IRS on this. Of course, that's one of the options. They can either say, all right, we will fight the charges against us under the tax code, or we will simply forfeit our tax-exempt status. They've decided to fight. We'll bring the update to you here in just a minute. Audio open lines for the last half, for the last hour here, but in just a few minutes, Uwe C. Minetto is going to join us via telephone. We're going to be talking with him about the comments made by Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez last week at the UN, particularly where he called the President of the United States a devil. The devil. Not just a devil, the devil, and claimed to smell sulfur. Then Dr. Alvin Schmidt will join us. We'll find out what Ramadan is really all about in the last half hour of the program. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the finding of a fossil. I've got this story right here in front of me. Where is it? Fossil of oldest child uncovered, according to the Chicago Tribune. We'll find out exactly what that is. Frank Sherwin of the Institute for Creation Research will be our guest. Well, here's a story. We brought this story to you a couple weeks ago, and here's the update about this IRS crackdown on a church in Southern California.
They were praising the Lord and thumbing their noses at the Internal Revenue Service at All Saints Episcopal Church, vehemently denying claims that they have violated any political campaigning laws.
This entire case has been an intrusion, in fact, an attack upon this church's First Amendment rights to the exercise of freedom of religion and freedom of speech.
This was no ordinary Pasadena Episcopal service. People of all faiths came to support All Saints.
One church is under attack, all churches under attack.
All Saints was hit with a summons demanding a meeting with the IRS and all paperwork relating to politics. The IRS investigation began after an anti-war sermon by retired pastor George Regas just before the 2004 election. He preached Jesus would call the war in Iraq a failed doctrine, but said, "I don't intend to tell you how to vote." We were there when the IRS first launched its probe.
Are you sorry you preached that sermon?
My feeling is that I would preach it again with greater intensity.
And we were there this week when, surrounded by supporters of all faiths, the church announced it will fight the IRS.
American pulpits in mosques, synagogues, temples, and churches must not cower from the responsibility to speak truth to power.
What happened to All Saints is part of a nationwide crackdown by the IRS.
In 2004, we began to see an uptick in activity. We saw a lot more complaints coming into us. We saw a lot more money flowing into campaigns. We began to be concerned that this might be getting out of hand.
About half of the 110 tax-exempt organizations the IRS investigated after the 2004 election were churches. 37 were found to have violated the law. One watchdog group concerned about the increased political activity of some conservative organizations just sent out 117,000 warning letters to churches to steer clear of partisan politics.
By deciding not to turn the other cheek, church leaders know they may be setting themselves up for a long and costly legal battle and the potential loss of All Saints' tax-exempt status. Sandra Hughes, CBS News, Pasadena, California.
You know, the more I think about this issue, just as a matter of practicality, the more I think about this issue, the more I think churches, we should just simply amend the tax code and get rid of this tax-exempt status for churches. That way, churches who foolishly want to politic and waste people's time on Sunday morning talking about politics and party politics and who you should vote for can go ahead and do it. And they can turn themselves into political organizations and hopefully abandon all pretense of preaching the gospel. They can just become what they've wanted to be all along. If a pastor wants to be a political consultant or the local party representative or a mouthpiece for any particular candidate, he can do it and everybody pays their property taxes. And the churches all pay their taxes the way the rest of us have to do it. I can put a sign out on my front lawn for any candidate I want, for any party I want. Why? I pay my taxes. I don't go home and say, I want tax exempt status and then put the sign out on my front lawn. So, I think it would solve a lot of problems. The churches that don't want to be churches anymore can go and do it. And the churches that want to continue to preach the gospel and make the subject of their sermons not whether the war is right or wrong, or whether this party should retain the Congress, you know, Jerry Falwell saying God will protect the Republican majority in the legislature. The churches that don't want to be churches can stop being churches, and the churches who want to remain the church and proclaim Christ for sinners can do that. And everybody pays. And no one can whine about religious discrimination because they've intentionally violated the tax code.
An Alfred Hitchcock movie could use it as a scenario. I would even propose a title: The Devil's Recipe. I think that the first people who should read this book are our brothers and sisters in the United States, because their threat is in their own house. The devil is right at home. The devil himself is right in the house. And the devil came here yesterday. Yesterday, the devil came here. Right here. Right here. And it smells of sulfur still today.
That's Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, the comments he made last week at the General Assembly of the UN, calling President Bush, I'm assuming he's talking about President Bush because the president was there the day before him, calling President Bush the devil several times, to applause and scattered laughter of the General Assembly. Dr. Uwe Simonetto joins us to talk about these comments. I don't even know what to make of them. Perhaps he was joking. Perhaps it was tongue-in-cheek, just like Jerry Falwell talking about Hillary Rodham Clinton. Uwe's an international journalist, a regular guest, and director of the Concordia Seminary Institute for Lay Vocation. Uwe, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Don.
What was your reaction when you heard about Hugo Chavez's comments?
Well, I wasn't laughing, I tell you what. I mean, here is this guy who is heavily involved in a cult, and of which we are going to, discuss hopefully in a minute, calling the president the devil. I mean, you know, even Hitler wasn't called the devil, even though he was probably devilish, in a public realm or a diplomatic realm. It is unbelievable, this sort of thing. But unfortunately, he gets a lot of applause. And you know, I don't think that the protests against that from the other side of the aisle in this country were particularly forceful. But no, it made me quite angry. But I mean, here the guy is in control in the sense of the United States, because he sits on this huge pile of oil, and he has gas stations all over this country, and. And every time you pump fuel into your car and into your SUV at his gas stations, you're helping him build up a dictatorship and an empire that is totally anti-American. Because we're not just talking about Venezuela; we're talking about plans he has for the rest of certainly the northern part of South America.
Okay, let's talk about both of those aspects. You mentioned this rather bizarre cult.
Yeah.
In which Chavez plays a part. Explain that, and then we'll talk about the political concerns surrounding Chavez and his dictatorship in Venezuela.
Right. The cult in which he plays is a very bizarre cult, but which is, affects maybe a third of the Venezuelan population and has over 600,000 members fully participating. It's called Maria Leonza. It is an extremely bizarre cult. That goes back to the teachings of a Frenchman, a 19th century French school teacher, teachings that have become quite popular again in the United States as well. This guy was called Alan Kardec. And Alan Kardec taught that a soul, while in transit from one state, one uh, body to the next could be appealed upon for guidance. And now, for a long time, Kardec, Hugo Chavez, claimed at first that he was praying to Simon Bolivar, the unifier of South America or Northern South America. Then at some point, a warlock came in from Germany and a witch from Venezuela, and they jointly declared that Chavez was actually the reincarnation of Simon Bolivar. Now here he is reincarnate and at the same time worship him himself. That's quite a nice devilish existence. And so there are altars all around the countryside, especially in the barrios and the slums, decorated with busts of Hugo Chavez. Of course, they're always decorated with busts of Simon Bolivar, because Simon Bolivar is one of the principal souls to be appealed to. The brujos, these are the mediums who then transmit the news or the voices of these souls. These brujos have to be made drunk. In the case of Simon Bolivar, they have to be served very good brandy. Lesser saints can be satisfied with cheap hooch, but in this particular case, it's that. The thing would be laughable, and that would be enough if it did not apply, if this cult did not not capture the imagination of the very electorate that Hugo Chavez has. And these are the inhabitants of the barrios, in other words, in the slums, where the church, in this particular case the Roman Catholic Church principally, but also the Protestant churches, have failed to evangelize properly. So now you have this curious mix of religions here. And this religion, the Maria Leonza cult or the Kardec cult, is related to theosophy and later incarnations, including Neo-Satanism as practiced here in the United States. There is a direct line from Kardec via the creator of theosophy, the theosophy movement, to Aleister Crowley, who was a demented Englishman who created a form of neo-Satanism that is now quite prevalent in this country.
Does Chavez actually believe this stuff, or is he simply using this cult, its adherents as his electorate, and their beliefs to his political, his dictatorial ends and purposes in Venezuela?
Well, listen, Chavez, like Hitler, certainly believes in some form of providence. Obviously, it's not the God of Christianity, but Hitler used the word providence all the time. And Chavez did that. And also, before Chavez was elected president, and in between his being jailed, because he sat in jail for having tried to overthrow the legally elected government at the time, and then is actually being reelected or being elected, he always had a cult to Simon Bolivar. In fact, he always kept a chair in his meetings of his party. One empty chair, that was a chair of Simon Bolivar. Now, you might say that it's highly illogical. How can he be venerated as the reincarnation of Simon Bolivar, and how can he then keep the chair empty? Well, we are not talking about rational things here, but the fact that he turned Simon Bolivar into an idol tells you a lot, because it was not... When he did this, when he kept this empty chair all the time, that was not common knowledge for the countryside. It was known to those who were interested in Venezuelan politics.
All right, then let's turn, if we could, to the political side of what ought to be U.S. concerns regarding Venezuela and Hugo Chavez as president. He was there speaking at the UN, obviously, at that body's invitation. He expressed a great number of ideas among calling the president the devil. What are your basic political concerns about Venezuela and about its influence in South America?
Well, my basic political concerns are that he is obviously trying to reconstitute Simon Bolivar's empire, which back in the 19th century collapsed after 10 years in 1930, was called Gran Colombia. He has significant successes in establishing links with the FARC, which is are the narco guerrillas who are hardline communists, but very, very rich, as he indeed is very rich. All previous communists were poor. These communists are very rich. He has oil, the narco guerrillas have narcotics. And then, of course, you have now Evo Morales over in Peru, who is very much a follower of Chavez. You have other left-wing groups throughout South America that are could be quite tempted by Chavez's charisma, if you will, and of course by this idea of establishing an empire. Now he can play and does play the oil card. So every time the Americans use too much oil, which unfortunately is the habit of this country, they are actually feeding not just Chavez but other enemies of the United States with this oil money. At the same time, every time some fool in this country snorts crack, he should know that with that he's funding an anti-American, an anti-Western, and of definitely anti-Christian movement that is in Venezuela, in Colombia. And all of these movements have one common goal, and that is to establish a powerful, very anti-Western empire in the northern parts of South America. Now, you go a little further than that. Chavez is rearming his forces with Russian arms. Morales has just handed over, or is in the process of handing over, his gas fields, huge gas deposits there, natural gas deposits, to the Chinese to exploit. When Jimmy Carter sold the Panama Canal, guess who is now the major player in the Panama Canal zone? Chinese warehouses, Chinese warehouse operations. The Chinese are very heavily involved in that region, none of which is much reported in this country, but it is still a fact, and it has to be considered as a huge, huge national security threat to the United States. And I can only reiterate, if the Americans continue to act irresponsibly with their use of oil and with their drug consumptions and all these things, they're not only hurting themselves individually as persons, but they're actually hurting their nation, because these people mean business. And Chavez, who is also a close friend of Fidel Castro's, means business. He's out to get the United States.
You mentioned Castro. A couple months ago, when the Cuban leader Fidel Castro was rumored to have died, of course, proved to be untrue. But
right.
At the time, during those weeks after, when he didn't appear, all eyes turned to Hugo Chavez. And the Venezuelan president was actually instrumental in trying to establish that Castro was still alive. I think he made a visit to Cuba, claimed to have visited with Fidel Castro. But what does it tell you that the up until, you know, Chavez's rise, the epicenter of communism in the Western Hemisphere, when Fidel Castro is rumored to have died, everybody immediately begins looking to Chavez?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And somehow, Western liberals very often get sort of lovely goosebumps, you know, how wonderful it is to have something naughty like these guys there. Yes, they turn to Chavez, and Chavez plays up, plays in a sense to the liberal left wing mentality in certain circles here in this country and in Europe. But in reality, he is of course, infinitely better equipped to harm the United States than Cuba was. What can you do with sugar cane? Not very much. But you can do a lot of harm by playing, you know, not just the oil game. They have enormous gold deposits. Venezuela is an immensely rich, usually badly run, but immensely rich country. Fantastic soil. It's a wealthy country. All sorts of metal deposits, precious metals, precious stones, all that stuff you have in Venezuela, and all of which now serves in a curious way to fight a battle against the United States.
Uwe, before we let you go, your organization, the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, is sponsoring a great forum that's coming up here in November called Call to Engage the Lutheran Voice in Contemporary America. It's going to be November 3rd and 4th on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. With only about 30 seconds, give us a brief preview of this forum upcoming there in November.
The forum will really be a wake-up call to American Lutherans to get involved and show their treasure chest and apply their treasure chest to the United States. Get involved in America. There will be scholars from various Christian groups, Catholic, evangelical, and others who say, where are the Lutherans now that we need them? And that's what's going on. These are prominent scholars, and I do hope a lot of people will attend here and listen to this wake-up call, because I think Lutheran theology has some very, very interesting thoughts pertaining to post-modernity, and might be serve as an excellent medicine against the postmodern troubles.
Among those who will be at this November 3rd and 4th conference on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis called Call to Engage the Postmodern World, the Lutheran Voice in Contemporary America, Dr. Mark Knoll, Notre Dame University, Dr. Robert Rosini of Concordia Seminary, Harold O.J. Brown, a Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina, St. Louis's own Father Gregory Lockwood of Cardinal Kenrick Glennon Seminary, and Dr. Robert Benne of Roanoke College. Uwe will be the moderator, and he's brought it all together. For more information on this forum, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, click links, and you'll find a direct link to our guest, Uwe C. Minetto, and the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, and this upcoming forum. Uwe, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Uwe has also written a recent column on the subject of Hugo Chavez. It's titled Bolivar's Red Reincarnation. Just go to our website again, issuesetc.org, and when you click links, you'll find Uwe C. Minetto and the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. And that column, you can read the entire thing in its detail there. When we come back from this break, Ramadan has begun. Now, some Muslims begin Ramadan a day here, day later than others. That's a big issue. When do you begin Ramadan? But the question for this last half hour of the program is, what is Ramadan? Why do Muslims celebrate it? What are they celebrating? We'll be right back with the answer to those questions.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Every month, we tell you about our Issues, Etc. book of the month. Well, our book of the month for September isn't a book. It's an audio CD and a companion booklet. It's called Listening to Luther. On this audio CD, Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb narrates Luther's Small Catechism. This narration is accompanied by hymns that fit the theme of each part of the catechism. Listening to Luther is $14.99. You can find it at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. When you stop by, mention Issues Etc. and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the audio CD, Listening to Luther. The two locations, 3558 South Jefferson or on the campus of Concordia Seminary. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Listening to Luther.
Noah's Flood. It sure left its mark. Answers with Ken Ham, one of the authors of the new book, War of the Worldviews. Ken, I know you say that most of the fossil record over the earth is the graveyard of Noah's flood, but is there other evidence consistent with this global catastrophe?
Mark, I was sitting recently in a lecture hall listening to meteorologist Mike Ord give an illustrated lecture concerning Noah's flood. You know, it was quite remarkable. First of all, he showed massive evidence all over the world for what's called sheet erosion. You see, if the waters of the global flood ran off the earth, as the Bible clearly states it did, well, we'd expect to see evidence of this. For instance, when you go to the Grand Canyon, as I did last June, you notice that the area around it is very flat. Every now and then you see sections rising from the flat area made up of many sedimentary layers. But you find such structures like this all over the earth. This is consistent with massive amounts of water causing sheet erosion, taking most of the layers off in sheets but leaving small areas. Because such structures are over massive areas and appear on a global scale, well, it only makes sense on the basis of Noah's flood. Mike also showed numerous examples of rivers that run through mountains instead of around them. Again, it can only be explained as the floodwaters receded. You know what? It all makes sense. Genesis is true.
For more evidence that there really was a Noah's flood and that helps explain the disappearance of the dinosaurs, go to our popular website, AnswersRadio.com.
Here's what Galatians 3:24 says, "So the law was put in charge to lead us to Christ that we might be justified by faith." The Reverend Dr. Andrew Steinman unpacked that verse for us earlier today on the Bible Study program, and if you'd like to hear his explanation, tune in tonight. The Bible Study repeat this evening at 7:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Our Christ-centered programming on AM 850 KFUO is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters like Reggie and Doris Weehy of Hoffman, Missouri, the Reverend Greg Smith of St. Louis, and Roland Dannenberg of Redbud, Illinois. Here at AM 850 KFUO, we very much appreciate the prayerful and financial support you show with your gifts.
Underwriting on AM 850 KFUO provided by Reliable Heating and Cooling, Christian people who understand the value of bringing you God's Word on the radio. The folks at Reliable also know how important it is to have your furnace checked before winter. An inefficient or deteriorating heat exchanger costs you needless expense and could be dangerous. A preseason inspection from Reliable is convenient, affordable, and gives you peace of mind. Reliable Heating and Cooling, supporting the broadcast ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. At least two stories over the weekend on the beginning of Ramadan, the Islamic holy month. What's it all about? We're going to answer that question here in this last half hour with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, a regular guest on the program. Now, one of the stories in the Metro section of Friday's paper, U.S. Muslims Divided Over Method of Calculating Ramadan's Beginning, was also the subject of a story from the AP. And before we bring on Dr. Schmidt, let's listen to this story about Ramadan from the Associated Press.
Muslims around the Middle East are making preparations for the holy month of Ramadan. It's the Islamic calendar's holiest month and is meant as a time of reflection. Devoted Muslims abstain from eating, drinking, sex, and other indulgences from dawn till dusk. It's an effort to renew their focus on spiritual rather than material things. Palestinians in the West Bank town of Ramallah flocked to the streets and markets to buy groceries in preparation for the holy month. Bakers prepare sweets made from goat cheese. The month of Ramadan is the ninth month in the Islamic calendar. Muslims start fasting after the new moon in the Islamic calendar is sighted. At sundown each day, the fast is broken with prayer and a meal. Then the fast resumes the next morning at dawn. Muslims believe it was during Ramadan about 1,400 years ago that the Quran, the Islamic holy book, was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. During Ramadan, it's common for Muslims to go to the mosque and spend several hours praying and studying the Quran. Some even spend the entire night in prayer. In Iraq, Sunni Muslims started observing the month Saturday, while Shiites recognized the start of the month on Sunday or Monday. Muslims in Afghanistan also started observing Saturday. In the afternoon, people flock to the streets and markets to shop and prepare for breaking their fast. Carlotta Bradley, The Associated Press.
All right, there's the story from the AP. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is a regular guest on the program, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, and he's author of the book The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me again.
Okay, so if we're going to understand Ramadan, is it worth making any comparisons with other religious festivals outside of Islam? I mean, people say, well, Ramadan kind of falls late in the year, so it's kind of like the Muslim Christmas or something like that because of a Western calendar association.
Pretty hard to compare it to anything in Jewish or Christian circles. First of all, it doesn't fall late in the year. In fact, it varies every year. The Muslim calendar operates on the phases of the moon, and so its months are 29 and a half days long. This means that in a given year, compared to the solar calendar which we have, the Muslim calendar is 10.8 or 11 days shorter than is the calendar we go by, commonly called the Gregorian calendar, which was introduced in 1582 by Pope Gregory the 13th. So it moves, for example, it moves every year. It goes through a whole cycle. In fact, in 34 years, it'll go through a complete cycle. For instance, last year, the Ramadan month was from October 16 to November 14. In 2006, it was September 24, which is our present year, to October 24. And as you heard from the AP report, in some instances it varies a day before or after when it started. Then, for example, in 2007, it'll be from September 13 to October 13. In 2008, it'll be from September 2nd to October 1st. 2009, it'll be August 22nd to September 21st. So you can see it moves sort of backwards, upward through a cycle. And so when it can be, well, let's see, if it's in the middle of the summer, in 17 years, it'll be 6 months removed from that, or in 34 years, it'll be back in the middle of the summer again.
So that has to do with going by the lunar calendar.
That's right, exactly.
What are Muslims celebrating? What do they think they're celebrating during this Islamic holy month?
Well, basically, it's a celebration of two things. One, it is supposed to commemorate and remind Muslims that this, beginning with Ramadan month, supposed to remind them that this is when the angel Gabriel from Allah brought the Quran to Muhammad. That's one of the things. But more significantly, perhaps, is that this whole month is supposed to be a month of fasting. I think the AP reporter mentioned from dawn till sunset. See, the Islamic day, like the Hebrew day used to be, began with sunset and ended with sunrise, very opposite of what we have. And so the basic reason for Ramadan is a month of fasting, that during the daylight hours you do not eat, drink, smoke, or do any other kind of things that give you pleasure. And then in the evening you break the fast, so to speak, and then you eat, usually a couple hours later, a rather full meal.
So to say it's a month-long fast is really a month-long fast during the daylight hours.
That's right. It's not a fast that we are familiar with. For example, when Old Testament characters fasted, it was not just confined to daylight hours. It was a fast basically around the clock, and sometimes, most of the time, they did drink some water or liquid, but other than that, they didn't eat any food. So this fast is very different.
Well, let's talk about the fasting there and contrast it, if we could, with the Christian form of fasting. The Christian form of fasting has a long tradition. One would say its roots in the Old Testament, most certainly, but also in some of the sayings of Jesus himself, but is largely intended to be about self-mortification, that is, either preparation or an outward display of repentance, and as a healthy reminder of one's own mortality. I think that's a good summary, and there's more to it, obviously.
Right.
Is that what the Muslim is doing when he's fasting?
Well, there are vestiges or traces of that, yes, similar to that. But it's supposed to be a month where you reflect and become a better Muslim and be kinder to your fellow Muslims and of that thing. So it has a spiritual discipline that it's supposed to bring about, right? And in that sense, there's similarity to the fasting that we read about in the biblical days. However, there's also one notable difference that we should remember. Fasting, particularly in the Christian era, was never really biblically mandated. Now, there were rules made, for example, by popes and the like, that required a certain kind of fasting, if you will, during Lent, certain things you weren't supposed to eat, even the fish or Fridays for fish only. But those were never biblically mandated. In fact, Christians have often pointed to Colossians 2:16 and 17, where St. Paul, writing to the Colossians, kind of is upset with them. He said, "Let no one judge you in food or drink or regarding the festival of a new moon or Sabbath, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ." And so from the biblical point of view, New Testament, okay, if you want to fast, Luther, for example, spoke about fasting being a good spiritual discipline, but never did he say you have to do it.
Are the Muslims attempting to appease or earn favor or merit with Allah by performing these acts, among them fasting, during this month of Ramadan?
Yeah, definitely. See, the Islamic religion is very much a religion of works. You will be saved. You will, on the day of resurrection, which they do believe in, go either to heaven or to hell, depending on how good or bad of kind of a life you've lived.
So as you said before, Christian fasting, properly understood, ought to have nothing to do with attempting to please God. It is not a work whereby God is appeased or pleased.
Exactly right. Now, there may have been some, what shall I say, erring Christians who sometimes thought that way, but it's nowhere mandated in the New Testament, nor, for example, much of the theological writings, even of the church fathers.
Now, Muslims routinely pray five times a day. The devout ones do as a part of year-round devotion. During Ramadan, I take it that the pace of the prayers increases, or at least the quantity of them increases.
Quite right. And I might mention, among the Shiites, they pray only three times a day. The Sunnis pray five times a day. And so there's a little difference there. What you mentioned in terms of maybe more intense, more frequently, quite correctly, I think the AP reporter, again, if I may refer to her, mentioned worshiping during night hours, which technically is called Tarawih, T-A-R-A-W-I-H. And some do that. Now, again, how many of them do that, who knows? And they're also supposed to recite and learn the Quran more so during this month than any other time of the year.
We're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. If you got a question or comment on Ramadan, love to hear from you. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, you have mentioned many times in the course of conversations about Islam on this program that the average Muslim's acquaintance with the Quran itself is not, it cannot be likened to, say, a devout Christian's acquaintance with the New Testament or with the entire Christian scriptures.
Yeah, I think that's pretty safe to say, although I can't cite any statistics, but in my having studied Islam and what Muslims believe in terms of past and present, and even in terms of interviews I've had with you and with other radio stations I might mention, just had one a couple of weeks ago from Pittsburgh, I have had Muslims specifically tell me. In one case, a person says, "I've been a Muslim for 30-some years, and I have never read the Quran." I suspect there are quite a few, and I don't think we'll ever know the facts in terms of what really is the case, but as you and I know, that doesn't necessarily make them a great deal different than from a lot of Christians who have a Bible but never have really read it very much.
Now, for the Muslims, if I pick up my Bible in English translation and I read it, I can rest assured, provided it's a reliable translation, that I am I'm not one step removed from the Word of God if I'm not reading in its original language. But for the Muslims, if they read an English translation of the Quran, do they understand that as a direct connection with the very Word of God revealed through Gabriel to Muhammad?
Well, that's a very interesting question, one for the most part not really addressed by Muslims. Theoretically, the Quran should never be taken as an accurate reading unless you read Arabic. Now, there's another catch on this one, meaning classical Arabic. And most Muslims who speak Arabic today no longer handle classical Arabic language. And moreover, another thing that kind of obfuscates this is in terms of the fact that only about 15% of the Muslims worldwide are of Arab descent. So most Muslims cannot read, for example, the Quran in Arabic. Indonesia, for example, which has the largest population of Muslims, is by no means Arabic. And yet so they read the Quran in Indonesian language. And so when we hear this, it is, not an accurate picture of what really exists among Muslims. Most of them have to, at least 85%, have to read a translation of some kind.
What about almsgiving during Ramadan, Dr. Schmidt?
Well, that again is part of the fourth pillar, really. There are five pillars in Islam, and Psalm, often spelled as S-W-A-M-S-W-U-M, which means fasting in Arabic, is the fourth pillar, and this is what the month of Ramadan really underscores. There's something else that's also very interesting, which is never really talked about, and I've done quite a bit of research on it and still can't find definitive answers on it because I think no one wants to really address it. But just stop and think, which we and the media never ask these what I would call hardball questions. If you cannot eat or drink from sunrise to sunset, what does this do to the person who works in the heat of the desert in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else? In terms of dehydration, there definitely are problems in this regard. And they make exceptions for certain people who have certain physical problems. But even there, those who don't have problems, sometimes in some countries they give some of the people respite during the day so that the dehydration wouldn't become problematic and ultimately result in serious health problems. But that's it doesn't take a great deal of insight to think about when you're working in the heat of 120 degrees in some of those, Mideast countries, how can you survive without drinking water and not becoming dehydrated?
One of the things that I have wondered about every Ramadan, maybe it's just my imagination, but you mentioned the pillars of Islam. Do the pilgrimages to Islamic holy sites, are they apropos to the month of Ramadan? Is that a time when most Muslims hope to do this?
No, that follows usually 2 months after. It's usually the last month in the year. That's the month of the Hajj. And so where you go to Mecca, and they go there by the thousands and actually millions. So that follows a little later. Because Ramadan is the ninth month, and then the Hajj month comes basically the last month in the year.
On the final day or after the final day of Ramadan, how does a devout Muslim mark the end of Ramadan?
Well, they have a formally named celebration, which they call Eid or Id, Ul Fitr, F-I-T-R, or Id-Al-Fitr, again, F-I-T-R, which is the Feast of Breaking the Fast, or breaking the month-long fast that they had during the month of Ramadan. And gifts are often exchanged with one another. And in some cities, for example, they even hold on the 27th day of the month of Ramadan special kinds of fairs, if you will, for the people.
I wonder about the participation of non-Muslims in Ramadan. Here in the West, of course, where Islam is more liberalized and westernized, it's not unusual for Ramadan, for non-Muslims to be invited in, especially at the end. In fact, last year at the end of Ramadan, President Bush invited Muslims to the White House for the breaking of the fast, for that very feast you just mentioned. And I believe he participated in it by way of eating the feast with them. Is that just a Western phenomenon, or do Muslims consider this an opportunity to say, let's invite the non-Muslims in to break the fast with us?
It's primarily a Western phenomenon, because in other parts of the Islamic world where the non-Muslims are such small numbers or minorities, they summarily often get ignored. It's in this country that they do, and there's a political reason too, I believe. It is to do that is, again, to publicize them as being charitable and open to other people in our society. And so I think it has a political motive too, but I can't find it in the literature where it is advocated or mandated for Muslims to do that.
I want your reaction to something that appeared in Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch in an article about Ramadan. Muslims mark Holy Month with fasting and prayer. It's a quote from a representative of Islam locally, where, and this is what it says, Islam is a religion of peace. The word Islam itself means peace. We pray five times a day. I don't know how a person that prays five times a day can go out and cause violence all over the world. The reason we pray is to avoid sin and violence.
That, you're quoting from the papers?
Yes.
Well, first error there is Islam does not mean peace. Islam means submission. That's a common thing that is bandied about in our day and age, that Islam is peace. No. If they want to say Islam might work for peace, but the word itself means submission. You submit to whom? To the Quran, to the way Muhammad, for example, interprets the will of God, so to speak, or Allah. That's what Islam means. So that paper right there made a basic error, and it's done a great deal very, very often, unfortunately.
I was in the car yesterday very early, Dr. Schmidt, driving to a preaching engagement and listening to National Public Radio. One of the biggest stories they played Sunday morning, and we didn't get to this today during audio open lines. Perhaps tomorrow we'll be able to play the story about, and this was out on the West Coast that where the story came from, about Hispanic women on the West Coast being drawn to Islam, and many of them converting to Islam. The ones who did said, look, what they found in Islam was a greater respect for women than their former Roman Catholicism. What they found in Islam was protection, kind of a social cultural protection, and the higher view of women that they had in their previous culture. What do you make of that?
Well, it's true in many ways, not only about Hispanic women, but it's true, for example, after 9/11, when one would have thought that very few Americans would convert to Islam, a number of them have, and greater numbers of women have converted to Islam than men. Apparently under the delusion that they're going to have more freedom, and it's hard to conceive how they can conclude that when you see how Islam women have to be veiled, cannot, for example, talk to a man in public unless her husband is present. I cannot admit a man coming into the house if her husband, again, is not in the house. In addition to wearing the restrictive garb and the like, it's just very difficult to understand how these people can believe they're going to have more freedom than they've had previously. It just sort of, leaves you at a loss for words. And I want to make one other comment relative to the quote that you read from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Yeah.
When you talk about Islam, a religion of peace. There is another example that is cited, and I've talked to you about this before in previous interviews. Islam's messages of peace, for example, have been abrogated by the later, more recent passages. And every informed Muslim knows this. Every good encyclopedia written by Muslims will admit that. But again, when it comes to papers publishing, they say that, and our media, as I've said before, when they interview these individuals, and I don't care where the program is, they don't ever ask hardball questions. They always give them softball questions, and so they get away with this. For example, when they say Islam is a religion of peace, I would just love to hear one reporter say, here in the Quran, I'm going to cite you several verses that speak about direct violence that negate and have abrogated the passage before. It never happens.
One final question here, Dr. Schmidt, and a reaction to the very end of the Post story in Saturday's Post that I mentioned before. where this young woman Muslim says, look, it's a lifestyle, referring to Islam. It's a way of life because everything revolves around your religion. Islam is short on teachings and doctrines, strong on practice. What is the religion? If you could put it in a nutshell with 30 seconds, what is the religion that is Islam?
What is the religion of Islam? It's a religion, as I said a little while ago, of works trying to please God, and therefore makes it completely opposite of Christianity, where Paul says, by grace you are saved. And again, it's the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. In other words, we believe, ever since the Reformation in particular, we are saved by faith alone, and good works follow our belief in that we are saved by grace. They are a work of gratitude, not a work that will merit us getting closer or a better place in heaven or getting there in the first place.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Happy to do it. Well, Issues, Etc. is going to be broadcasting live from the Good Shepherd Institute. It's a yearly conference that's held on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This year, it's November 5th through the 7th, and we've been invited to bring our radio program up there for a live broadcast. Among the speakers there at the Good Shepherd Institute, Dr. Arthur Jess, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, Dr. Paul Grimm, John Pless, Dr. Kent Burrison, and Dr. Dan Zager. They'll all be there for the Good Shepherd Institute on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we will be there too. For more information on the Good Shepherd Institute, first week in November there at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. You'll see the logo for the Good Shepherd Institute right there on our homepage, or you can call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and get more information on the Good Shepherd Institute in November. Their number, area code 260-452-2204, area code 260-452-2244, I'm sorry, area code 260-452-2244 for information on the Good Shepherd Institute. Tomorrow on the program, there has been a fossil found. They say it's 3.3 million years old, and it's a skeleton of a young child. Well, they say it's connected to this common ancestor that for several years they were saying we all had, Lucy. We'll find out what it's all about this finding of a fossil alleged to be the oldest child ever discovered. Our guest tomorrow on the program, Frank Sherwin of the Institute for Creation Research. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.